A little idle chatter about the people that we know. And though it doesn't matter, is there a different way of saying hello?
You're listening to a podcast of The View, brought to you by the Church of the Larger Fellowship. To subscribe to this podcast, visit www.questformeaning.org or search for Church of the Larger Fellowship in the iTunes Store.
Hey, welcome to another episode of The View. Today we're joined by Judith Frediani to talk to us about all things religious education. And before we get to Judith, let's have our regulars introduce themselves. This is Meg Riley here in Minneapolis.
Hi, this is Aisha Hauser in Seattle, Washington.
I'm Alicia Ford calling in from Colorado.
And this is Michael Tino here in Peekskill, New York.
Alicia, you've been away for a while. What have you been doing?
I have. I spent 3 weeks back at my home in Tobago with my partner, which was lovely and sunny and not snowy and cold. And then just various travels for the UUA and for work. So it's actually really good to be back on The View and to see everyone.
Well, what's up where anybody's from, aside from the daily onslaught that we're all living with these days? Anybody got some good news? I'm all for that.
Well, the Women's March was, did you go to the one in Minneapolis, Meg?
I got sick over the weekend. I watched a live stream on Democracy Now! Of D.C., but I didn't go out. But 100,000 women, people here.
We had almost 200,000 in Seattle. And I noticed right away that, A, I hardly saw any police. And when I did, they were super nice and friendly. And I couldn't pinpoint why. Like, okay, it was a good thing, but it was also unsettling. And I realized, like, the next day when people were like, oh, look at Black Lives Matter demonstrations. Right. The police are not wearing cute hats and waving. So that was disconcerting. In fact, leading up to the march, somebody at church, a white woman, said to me, you know, I'm kind of worried. I said, worried about what? And she said, well, you know, we're going to be just something might happen. I said, I've actually been at Black Lives Matter marches, and that's where people worry because the police are either in riot gear. I said, I'm not even a little bit worried. And in fact, someone said it wasn't a march, it was a parade. And so, which was at least a parade for something good, I guess. But that was my experience. It was massive.
Yeah, they here and so many states, we have a new Republican majority in Minnesota in the House and Senate, thankfully still a Democratic governor. But, you know, they're passing legislation that the protesters need to pay for the police that are necessary. And I'm like, well, who decides they're necessary? Because every time there's violence at these things, the police start it. Let's be real. So, yeah, I totally agree. I mean, I heard people's analysis being, see, when it's women, there's not violence. And I was like, no, the lesson is see when there isn't police violence, there is not violence. So yeah, and I'm the arrests in DC for felony rioting give me great concern. 10 years in prison and a felony for, now admittedly, the people who are smashing things, I wish they'd go have their own damn protests and leave the nonviolent ones alone. Because in my experience, they're mostly straight white men, anarchists. They wear masks, they throw crap, they disappear, and other people get hurt and arrested. And I have no respect for them. If they want to do that, go have their own protests. I wouldn't go, but, you know, they'd have every right. But they're cowards. That's my opinion about them. Having watched them way too many times hurt people and tell the people of color in charge that they don't care. When the leaders say, please don't do that, that's not what we're doing. I don't care. So I have no respect for the destruction of hurting people and also destroying things if you're not going to claim it as what you're doing and put yourself behind it. And I don't even know what I'd think about it then, but I've never seen that. I've only seen cowardly hiding. Michael, what about you? Did you go to a march?
I did not attend the march here. I had a sick 3-year-old at home, so I stayed home and cooked a 4-course dinner for people who were marching in New York. So I got to welcome people who, they were not exactly tired from walking 6 blocks at 1/2 mile an hour. They were really energized and ready to eat.
Great. How about you, Alicia? There was a huge one in Denver, I know.
There was a huge one in Denver, and I went with a group of friends, and I had really mixed feelings being there. It was interesting listening to Aisha talk about police presence at the march you went to. I saw two police officers for a crowd of 200,000, and granted, there were probably more than that there, but you know, in Black Lives Matter protests, I tend to see far more police officers in much more threatening stances and riot gear. So for me, there was something about when you have a gathering that's majority white women, what the reaction is like and what law and order looks like in that setting. And, you know, Meg, you asked about uplifting stories. And last night we went to see Laverne Cox at the Mackey Auditorium at CU. And gosh, that was just an incredible experience. Really inspiring to listen to someone connect theory to activism and kind of how she lives it out in her life and her call to action. So it was a bright spot in an otherwise downer month or few months.
We have a viewer, Katie Cartman from Houston, adding that they've also seen the totally white anarchist male displays at Black Lives Matter events in Houston. I'm not saying that, you know, those are the only people who ever throw things, but the first thing that where it ever happened to me, I went to the Fourth Precinct and I was kind of standing back, you know, I had on my clergy collar, just trying to get the lay of the land. And these guys beside me started throwing things at the police. And then they disappeared into the crowd and the police shot rubber bullets and hit this 12-year-old black kid right by me. And those white guys were gone. And that's when I just thought, if I could, I would duct tape you to a telephone pole right now. I just felt very mad. Judith Frediani, did you go to the Boston March?
I did not. I had a conflict, but my daughter-in-law and three-year-old granddaughter went. I was very pleased to see two generations behind me participating. And I theorized that under a Trump administration, there may be another opportunity to march.
Probably in a few weeks.
Did you hear that? Yeah. There's a scientist march.
The scientist march. I love that.
Yeah.
Excellent.
My kids' line from age 6, because we lived in D.C. during the Bush administration. So as the war was, as we were gearing up for war, all we did was march. And so my kid one week says, I hate peace. Get me a babysitter.
I ask a philosophical, because I've been pondering. So I don't know if it was the inauguration day. I think it was inauguration day that someone was interviewing Richard Spencer, the neo-Nazi, and he got punched. And so until I saw a video of that, I thought I was a pacifist. But I felt really good about him getting punched, and I'm like, I would punch him in the face. And then my husband's like, that's not very nice. I'm like, no, it isn't, is it? And so I've been really struggling with that. Like, I'm not happy with myself that I felt so much satisfaction with him getting punched in the face. Like I felt not even a little bit. And then there was someone from my congregation, we were talking about it during the march, and she goes, well, I don't like that. I don't think we should punch people. I'm like, yeah, I want to think that, but I think some people can get punched. So I don't know. Is anyone struggling with this spiritually like I am?
I'm not struggling with it spiritually. I don't think I'm a pacifist. I realize this as a parent. There was a kid when Jai was 3 who kept pulling down Jai's pants. And I went to the school and I said, keep this kid away from my kid. And they didn't. And then I went to the counselor and they said, if you lodge a complaint, we will call the police in to have this child questioned about sexual assault. I'm like, it's a 3-year-old, right? And the kid's father was a police officer to top it off. So I said, I said to Jai, if it happens again, punch Khalil in the face. And Jai said, I'll get in trouble. And I said, no, you won't, because I'm going to tell your teacher that I told you to do this. And I'm going to tell Khalil that I told you to do this. So I went to Khalil and I said, Khalil, if you pull down Jai's pants again, I'd already had these really don't do it, blah, blah. I said, Jai will punch you in the face. And Jai is very good at punching. And Jai will not get in trouble, by the way. And you know what? He never touched her again, Jai again. And I felt like, oh, I'm not a pacifist, am I? Apparently. Ronald Reagan's peace through strength works for me sometimes, you know? So when I see that Nazi get punched, I'm like, because there's that other thing where the guy set up the camera for people to say, you know, we're resisting. And then a Nazi comes and says, Hitler didn't do anything wrong. And I see the news coverage of this, and the frame is that a Trump supporter gets punched in the face. Somebody who said Hitler didn't do anything wrong got punched in the face. If that's the definition of a Trump supporter, we are normalizing the abnormal really fast. You know, I'm not struggling with that. Like I said, I don't know what I'd think if violent protesters said, come and have a violent protest to Nazism. I don't even know what I'd think because it's never happened. They just poach on the organizers' work. And that's what feels absolutely wrong to me. So
there's a part of me, Meg, that wants to struggle with it, is kind of feeling guilty that I'm not struggling more. And maybe that's what Aisha's getting at. But this is a man who has openly called for the genocide of Black Americans. I think I'd be hard pressed to stop at punching him in the face. And I want to struggle with that. So at some part of my brain wants to struggle with that. And I'm not struggling as much as I want to.
Judith, maybe we need some faith development.
It sounds like you're on the journey all by yourselves.
So Judith Frediani, we got to work together way back at the UUA when we were both in the RE department. I joined it in 1989, and Judith had been there for a while doing curriculum development, went on to run the whole show. We were on leadership council together and is kind of, I'd say, semi-retired now, still participating in changing the world. So Judith, like, I was thinking back, somebody asked me when I first heard of institutional racism, and I realized it was when I went to the Winter Institute where Bill Jones talked about what he then called neo-racism. It was, I think, 1987, if I remember it right, so 30 years ago now. When did religious educators start wrapping themselves around systemic oppression and all of the anti-oppression work that you gave your life to?
I would say the 80s, which is why, you know, that conference was an RE conference. And I think we had Bill Jones a couple of times and lots of other speakers at Laredo and so forth addressing this in the 80s and 90s and so forth. You know, in the very early 80s, there was the survey/analysis of the state of RE, Stonehouse Conversations, by religious educators. It identified a lot of issues, almost all of which are still there today. But in its goals, one of the goals very strongly was social justice. And from that 1981-82 report, the Stonehouse Conversations, came a number of developments. One of them was hiring me, and actually hiring Elizabeth Anastas, David Marshak, and then me in 85 to develop resources for all of the goals, including justice. And so we actually created curriculum teams. And at first there was one social justice team, and then it was realized that's holding too much in one team. So there was a racial justice team, a social justice and peace team. And I would put that as the first time the UUA or the AUA or any incarnation of our headquarters said, racial justice, we're going to address it. And we're going to address it with children. We had curriculum for first graders through adults. And so that, I think, is a point you can point to. But it's more, of course, a manifestation of our commitment to racial justice, social justice, and religious education being two branches of the same tree, as Dick Gilbert and Bobby Nelson said also in the 80s.
Being a religious educator is foundational for me. It's primarily who I see myself to be. My observation in congregations is that the religious educators are, in a way, the community organizers, some of them more internally focused and some of them including external focus. How would you say, you know, you look at the interactions between those programs that started for all ages and then the life of congregations more broadly? How do those kids programs filter into the rest of congregational life or not?
Right. That's an excellent question. One that I wish you didn't ask because I don't have a happy answer. I feel that religious education in our congregations was way ahead of the top priorities of the congregation in general. On the more positive side, I think it definitely had an influence. You know, when the kids were pushing recycling and pushing diversity and celebrating peace and bringing that into worship and bringing it home. Yeah, I think it definitely strengthened what was always a stream in our faith history, which is justice. But like so many other things, like spiritual development and the meaning of our seven principles, RE seemed to take them more seriously than the sanctuary and the adult priorities.
Ishi, you've been both in the congregation doing this work and also at the national level developing the work. How do you see, you went, I think, from the local to the national, back to the local, right? So how do you see the interplay of the, you know, the really bold prophetic leadership interplaying with congregational life?
So I worked in a small congregation, medium size, then I went to the UUA. Now I'm at a large congregation. One of the things that I realized that I learned from Judith and being part of the team, the Faith Development Office in developing Tapestry of Faith, is that having a holistic approach to racial justice, social justice is crucial. When we do it wrong, I'm going to put that in quotes, we say, okay, we are going to talk about racism today. And then tomorrow we're going to talk about the sun. And then we're going to talk about climate. And if we don't talk about that interconnectedly, we're missing huge, there's no intersectionality. So I learned intersectionality from my work with Judith. And even with Tapestry of Faith, one of the things that's integral to the program are quotes and stories. And all of them are not by Emerson and Thoreau. So, you know, there was a lot of intention around whose voices are we lifting up. So I took that lens, having worked at the UUA, now at a large congregation, and say, hey, how we do anything is how we do everything. And so what lens are we applying to the congregation? So when I first got to East Shore, you know, membership was going down and people were like, you know, we're not attracting families. I said, well, when you're shushing babies in worship, you're not, who's going to want to stay? So it's the holistic lens. And if you want to be more diverse, how are you, you know, what songs are you singing in worship? What readings and what kind of lens? So it's the intersectional lens that I learned from curriculum development, specifically Tapestry, specifically working with Judith, who I see as one of my mentors. So that's the part that I think has been integral to what I learned at the UUA with Judith, is intersectionality in a truly it's the foundation. If we're not intersectional, it's really, I think, the biggest part of what I think came out of the Women's March for White Women. That the, you know, did everyone see the viral picture where the Angela Peoples is holding the sign that says "White women, don't forget, white women voted for Trump," and behind her are three white women taking selfies. So that's intersectionality, right? So that's what I would say. I don't know if I answered your question, but to me, that's my biggest learning.
Yeah, no, that's really interesting. So I know at Lareda this time, the conference where both of you were, that it was about topics we don't talk about. I forget how it was said. What was it? Secrets or
unmentionables or something?
Yeah. So how did I know that race was kind of a late addition to, I don't know, money and spirituality. I can't remember the original ones, and I wasn't there.
Sex. Money and death.
Oh, death. Okay. So how did it go? Did you feel like the conversations on all of those topics, but specifically on racism and race, were helpful, move things along?
So it was an interesting progression, because initially, you know, Lareda Fall Conference gets planned a year out in advance. So the Faith Development Office under Jessica and Gail Forsyth Vale, Jessica York, Gail Forsyth Vale, and Pat Kahn and Melody Davis worked on Get Death, Money, and Sex at the Our Whole Lives program. And late spring, folks, you know, obviously Black Lives Matter, the racial tensions have just been much more to the forefront. And so a group of folks in Lareda said, hey, you can't do Fall Conference without having a part about race. So how that was dealt with, so the three big topics had a day, specified time, and then added on an hour each day was the race part. The first day, multiracial conversation. The two following days, we caucused, so white folks were together. They were in the very big rooms. There were many more white people, and the people of color, the religious professionals of color, met in a different room. And I actually liked when we separated better, because there's just, you know, an hour on racism just isn't, when you're in mixed and you know, we didn't do pre-work, we didn't do groundwork. I have to be honest, it wasn't that, that was my least favorite. But right. when we separated and then I was with, you know, other religious educators of color, it just felt much more comfortable for me. So what do you think, Judith?
Well, there's never enough time, and there certainly isn't enough time when you have four topics of great interest, of importance. I did not fully participate. I was there for the Odyssey. It seemed like very well organized, interesting participatory activities, but very 101, you know, just 101, given the nature of, as Aisha said, I think the resources that were presented in the conversations that were started, I hope have value to the participants when they return to their congregations, because that's what Loretta Fall Conference is all about.
Judith, I would love for you to talk about your Odyssey, because I think it was the best Odyssey I've ever heard at Loretta. Usually Odysseys, what they are is, you know, folks tell their life story, their journey, and you focused on rankism. And because it's still a and I, you know, please explain what that is and what you touched on, because it's still a challenge. And for me, if we as a faith are going to commit, and I hope we are, and I actually had a minister say to me, don't make the assumption that everyone wants to commit to anti-racism work, but I want to commit to that. We need to be open and honest about how rankism affects our own community. So can you talk about your Odyssey? That would be great.
Thank you, Aisha. When I was asked to do the Odyssey, which is a great honor, my reaction was, I don't want to talk about myself. Although I did talk about my theological journey at the beginning, I could not separate my professional life from that of other religious educators. And I couldn't separate my professional life really from my sense of self and life experiences. I remembered reading about Robert Fuller's concept and theoretical model of rankism. In fact, I did entitle my Odyssey Linked, Not Ranked. Fuller, who was a physicist, I believe, and an educator, he was once the president of Oberlin College. After leaving that, he really spent the rest of his life as a social reformer for peace and dignity. And he developed this model about 10, 12 years ago and has built on it to the present. Rankism, what is it? Essentially, it's an assertion of superiority. It's when people who think they're somebodies, with a capital S, put down people they think are nobodies, with a small n. It is basically the abuse or misuse of power and rank. He says that rank is not the problem, rankism is. So, of course, we're going to have hierarchies. Hierarchies can be justified. Hierarchies can be useful and productive. We're not going to do away with them, and we don't have to do away with them. But if you have a rank that is above other ranks, that is, you have power over, your responsibility is to serve and protect your subordinates, not to exploit them, abuse them, insult them, denigrate them, ignore them, treat them as invisible. These are all abuses of power, and that's what he calls rankism. And what I found really intriguing about rankism and sort of appealing about it is that I think it addresses situations that are not obviously racism or sexism or whatever. All of those he considers species of rankism, you know, white superiority and power over people of color, you know, those are rankisms. And they play out in the macrocosm and, of course, in the microcosm. There's also when it's two white people, two white women, two white women of a similar socioeconomic and educational background, right? Is that sexism? I think we tended in the old days to say, well, it's internalized sexism. You know, the one who's exploiting the other is internalized male supremacy. Well, that's another model. Rankism is universal. Everyone experiences it. Nobody is the top somebody all the time. Everyone experiences rankism, quite possibly several times every day. And some of it may be because of race or ability or something, or other reasons. So we all experience it, we all hate it, and we all react in different ways to it, including getting sick, getting demoralized, being unhappy, or being really angry. And one of his quotes that I like is, "There is no fury like that born of chronic humiliation." Rankism has tremendous personal and societal costs. I couldn't help, as a woman and as an educator and as a religious educator, I couldn't help thinking, yes, rankism we experience from birth. Well, for example, I was a public high school teacher before I became a religious educator. And I was a high school teacher, which has a little, has more rank than a grammar school teacher, but has a lot less rank than a professor, someone who teaches adults, right? And so at the time, my husband was a professor and had like 12 hours a week of work. And I had like 55 hours a week of work. And he got 4 times more than I did. When I was with other teachers and met other teachers, they'd say, "Oh, what do you teach?" And I'm like, "High school history." And like, "You teach high school? Oh my God, I could never teach high school." And because it's perceived to be harder and requiring more knowledge and so forth. And I'd say, "You teach first grade? Oh, how could you teach first grade? I could never teach first grade. All these little kids." There's just such rankism in every profession and across society. If you work with children, you have less status than if you work with adults. Religious educators, as I asked in my Odyssey, what does rankism have to do with religious education? And I would have loved everyone to have their chance to respond to that. As largely a female profession, working with children in a culture and an organization, the religious business, where ordained ministry is the top of the hierarchy. And it's not just UU. I mean, it's any religious organization I'm familiar with, except maybe Buddhism, some forms of Buddhism. So we're women, we work with children, and we're not ordained, or if we are, if we're ordained MREs, ministers of religious education, still there's rankism. Let's talk about that. It explains a lot about our experience as religious educators, and so that's why I chose that as a theme.
So let's get specific about that, Judith. I know, having been a religious educator in a congregation and now being a minister, I remember I was going to be a minister of religious education. That's where I was headed. And at the time, it was an independent study program that was not accredited. And I had gone to an accredited seminary, and to be ordained, I had to test for things I'd already taken in an accredited school. I had to take a test to prove that I knew them. And how, I mean, and I refused. That's when I just said, "No, that is what you do to women. And no, why would I do that?" And other religious educators have said to me about accreditation that, unlike ordination, if you're an accredited DRE, you spend all that time. But when you leave Unitarian Universalism, it means absolutely nothing. Whereas I'm ordained, that speaks some universal language to the world. I'm curious about things like that, about the ways that I've seen religious educators within that community pull rank on each other. And of course, as you say, it's ubiquitous. We're all doing it all the time. But having lived through some time at the UUA together, we've watched various hierarchies emerge around the place of religious education in the wider movement. And now we're in a presidential election time. And I'm wondering what you would want to say to all of the presidential candidates about what you learned from decades at the UUA in different configurations with rankism.
I think there was more than one question there.
Oh, maybe just a few.
I want to start with one of your earlier questions about the whole accreditation, ordination, hoops you have to jump through thing. Elizabeth Young Brule, who wrote Childism, that is prejudice against children and the actions based on prejudice against children, it can be very patronizing. And I love her example of Christian theologians who invented purgatory for kids and infants, because it's not quite as bad as hell. Because the, you know, incredible torture of hellfire doesn't last for infinity, but only for maybe thousands of years. And so something, and believe me, this is what I was taught as a child, And so something, an accommodation had to be made for those children. You know, hell was just a little bit too much. I felt the same way about the accreditation programs at the UUA and before the UUA. I think they maybe were even weaker. You can't really do divinity school. And sort of like, well, wait a minute, why not? Well, you're not paid enough to pay for it. You have family responsibilities, so you can't go away. So we'll make this other little program for you rather than addressing why don't women have access to divinity school, have the equal opportunity of that. Now, Miva Lombard, for example, has obviously, well, and Star King too, have obviously made, tried to address that, not just for Resedge kids, but all ministers, by making these, you know, non-residential programs. That was a long time coming. So what the UUA tried to do back in the 80s and into the 90s was make a non-residential program because no theological schools were doing that for women. I mean, that's my reaction to your question about accreditation programs. It's trying, you know, in some sense, good faith in trying to offer an opportunity that society doesn't offer, but also it's patronizing and it doesn't have the status because the hierarchy says degrees from accredited colleges and universities is the rank you need to be taken seriously. What would I tell the candidates? My main issue, returning religious education and religious educators to the table of power, you know, the ranking table at the UUA is the president's leadership council, whatever a president will call it. And by removing a religious educator from that, happened to be me after 9 years there serving there, but removing any religious educator from that table is not only a gross mistake in terms of good decision-making, good analysis and so forth, but it's also an expression of the problem. It's a manifestation of the sexism and the childism and the rankism and everything else that you think, religious educator doesn't have to be at the top table. The IT person does and the development person does and all these other things, but religious educator? No. That, you know, is, and of course that was done by removing a department of religious education, putting it under the ministry department. So it's also a manifestation of a structural change that has enormous implications for funding and power and decision making and hiring and every aspect of administration. So that's what I would say to candidates.
It was a real it was so heartbreaking when that happened, Judith. And I've told Peter Morales, president of the UUA, directly how disappointing that was, especially because he was the candidate that got a lion's share of the religious educator support. And so to be diminished in that way has been awful. And I do want to tell you that I have endorsed one candidate, but I've spoken to all three candidates about that specifically, that this was not good for religious education. It wasn't good for religious educators, and it's not good for our faith to not have a religious educator at the leadership council. And I've also talked to other folks on the leadership council, and I voiced my disappointment. And I've kind of waited for one person to say to me, no, we lift up religious educators. And I promise you, not one person has said, no, don't worry. You know, we lift you up. Not one person said that. It was like, you know, kind of nod and smile type thing. So I'm like, okay, this is a problem. And I don't understand. I still kind of don't get why it happened, but it doesn't matter. We can't get into Peter's head, but.
And we'll be having all three candidates on this show in the coming months. So we'll have a chance to talk about that and many other things with them. I'm curious, in this time that we're in now, which is a pretty intense time, if you were in the role that you have for a long time of kind of overseeing the whole team, are there things that you would be creating that you didn't get a chance to?
I'm very proud of my staff, very proud, and very proud that they actually agreed to come and stay and work with together. And I'm very proud of Tapestry of Faith and our whole lives. Probably the regret I have is that I didn't mobilize religious educators. I mean, I tried, but I didn't spend a lot of time doing that. I think I didn't feel I was authorized to really try to get them to organize and be activists on their own behalf, except for kind of telling them that occasionally. And I think that I don't think there's any question the institution did not want me to do that. But I wish I had been more competent to inspire action on their part and their own behalf, which means on behalf of congregants and youth and children and babies. And in general, I think I would like to have been able to mobilize and supply resources for community organizing, which Asia had referred to earlier. Tapestry of Faith, in every single session and workshop, every single one has a faith in action. It's a way to take action, and it's either service or social change, and justice seeking and peace seeking. And we're very proud of that. Really, community organizing, not that I could do that alone, but spearheading that skill, I would be doing that now. I would do that now.
Judith, our Lareda administrator who's watching live noted that religious educators can only vote at General Assembly if they are voted as delegates from their congregation, whereas I believe ministers automatically get the right to vote. And for a credentialed religious educator, you can only be at the master's level. So even if you do the regular credentialed, you can't vote unless you are a delegate. So we're still, it's rankism again. I also want to lift up that our whole lives, that's also, in addition to Tapestry, one of your just crowning achievements, one of many. So I want to, because that's at this point now, I think OWL is now social justice. It feels like a social justice program, especially light of the current administration.
I was asked, as I think I said in my honesty, Makana Morris, who was then the director of the Religious Education Department of the UUA, told me that I needed to get involved in the evaluation of EYS and the development of a new sexuality education program. And I said, I don't know anything about sexuality education. I'm really not that interested in it, actually. And she said, Judith, you're the curriculum director. You have to do this. I was actually a little reluctant, but then, wow, what an experience and what a contribution the UUA has made.
What a contribution to Unitarian Universalism. All the people, not only who have taken that themselves, but who are offering it to their communities and using it as outreach. And I think it'll become more and more important in this administration as we resemble the dominant culture in charge, much less to be asserting our values.
So, I just wanted to add that, of course, UUA sexuality education work has been central to my life and ministry too. And I think one of the things that I want to lift up in OWL is that, you brought in the sexuality education expert to make it a sexuality education curriculum, but because there were people involved in OWL, yourself included, and others who were faith development experts and education experts, the curriculum does so much more than sexuality education. And the curricula, they really help our folks. I can't say enough about developing the self-worth that OWL teaches them to have and what that means, especially in a society that's telling people that they're not worthy. And I don't think that's the sexuality education part of it, right? That's the folks who were religious educators working on that did that. So I want to lift that up and thank you for that.
Thank you.
So Judith, I'm curious, what would you say, what words of wisdom or insights would you offer to folks coming into religious education now?
Wow. Look at your options outside the profession of religious education. I'm sorry, but I'm just candid. I taught for, I think, 14 years at Harvard Divinity School. I taught UURE to Divinity students, and I just finished last semester, I think my last time I will ever teach that course at that institution, because I was just an interim till they want to settle someone more permanently. In all that time, going back to 2001, I think, I've never had a Divinity student who wanted to be a religious educator, I mean, as a profession, as a rank okay, as a rank. You know, you don't have the pay, you don't have the status, you don't have the benefits. Although those have all increased, but there's still no, there's almost no full-time positions. So I guess what I would say is that it is one of the most important jobs in the country. Make sure your expectations are realistic, or you will set yourself up for anger and frustration and resentment or other unhappy feelings if you think that it is not without its disrespect, its limits, its professional limits. So if you're realistic, the other thing I would say, be realistic about your expectations, but don't be limited by the limits of the situation. I don't know why more religious educators don't quit, don't demand more, and see whether the congregation really can't meet some reasonable demands for better pay or better benefits and so forth. So I think you need to be prepared to, for your own limit on what you'll accept in terms of respect, in terms of pay. And remember, I understand most of our congregations are very small. You can't expect a full-time salary. I'm not talking about that. But respect doesn't cost money. And read Fuller and Rankism about the many humiliations when our microaggressions, as we say in the oppression field, decide what you will stand and how you will react to those. And then you might be a healthy, happy person in the position.
Whoa, Judith, that was very realistic. That was shockingly realistic.
I'm sorry. You know, since I've retired, I am getting a little bit more candid publicly.
I love that. It was on the money, Judith, and I tell people that too. So I think it was excellent, and it's important to go in with our eyes open, because really the one profession that's held up and has automatic respect is ordained ministry. And it feels like, you know, it doesn't have to be a pie. We can all lift each other, right? It doesn't have to be that ministers get 95% of the pie and religious educators and musicians and administrators and everybody else gets the 5%. I don't know. It feels like we see it that way, and that's unfortunate. But I appreciate your advice, because it's absolutely on the money. And I kind of tell people a version of the same thing.
Well, you know, it's interesting you say how our ministers at the top, and they are within our field. But they definitely don't feel that they have the same status that they used to have. There were the complaints about the feminization of the clergy being bringing it down. I think there's a basis for that concern, because society is sexist. And so, you know, we talk about the fragility of white or white privilege, whatever. D'Angelo, what does she say? White fragility. Well, there's also ministerial fragility, which I've observed, you know, really for decades, and partly, of course, being very much engaged with ministers and being a ministerial spouse for many years. Ministerial fragility is also a consequence of a system based on rankism, which is based on, you know, competition and one-upmanship and
Judith, since you're retired and I'm not, can you write that article for UU World about ministerial fragility? Because I can't.
You and Tom Shade could write it together, I bet.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, well, what does he say?
He's talked a lot about white fragility. I would be very interested now that he's retired as a minister, what he would say about ministerial fragility. I'm sorry he's not here as a host today, because that would be very interesting.
In a ranked society, a society not only ranked but full of rankism, everyone is fragile. You know, I'm not pointing at any, like, oh, ministers. Everyone is vulnerable and fragile, a society based on rankism.
Right. There's real fragility and vulnerability. And then there is the perception that your feelings are more important than the realities of other people, which is what white fragility is kind of about. Like, let's talk about me. So anyway, Michael, you were kind of getting excited by that.
As you know, as a parish minister currently in that field, I think Judith's analysis is right on. And if we had another hour, now that Judith is being candid, I'd probably want to hear what she would have to say to her ministerial colleagues to help to help us, frankly, get out of that system, to help us get out of that, the rankism. I mean, part of it is just treat people with respect and dignity.
Yeah, that's in a sense, that's all of it, actually. But it's not simple. I mean, that's a complicated and deep revolution, if it were so. Well,
thanks to Aisha Hauser, who is a friend of Robin D'Angelo. Robin is the Foss lecturer at GA this year. She was a guest here, gave a great conversation here about white fragility. And thanks so much, Judith. Is there anything you wanted to say that we didn't ask you that you're like, but wait, I really wanted to tell you whatever?
Something that Michael Tino said, that the idea of getting parish ministers and maybe DREs, religious educators, together to talk about how they can overcome rankism, I think is a great idea. And I do that with my students. I have them interview a parish minister and a religious educator, but not in the same church. Otherwise, you got, you know, two different congregations, with the question, how can the minister support the religious educator? Does the religious educator, how would she or he like to be supported by the parish minister? That was a very, very profound exercise for these students. That's a conversation that could be had.
Yeah, that's a great conversation. But I think having somebody retired with nothing left to lose is a great place to start it, because when you are in that power relationship, it's a lot harder to speak the full truth. Thank you so much for being yourself. Thanks to the panelists. Alicia, it's great to have you back. Next week, we're going to be talking about this new thing called UU Talks, and we'll be talking with Peter Bowden and Twinkle Marie Manning, who are creating these UU Talks, and I'm excited to learn what they're doing. Meanwhile, be kind to each other.
This has been a podcast of The View, brought to you by the Church of the Larger Fellowship. To find out more about the CLF, visit questformeaning.org.